I'm Marie Bernard, host of Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. Join me Mondays at noon as we explore the universal energy that connects us all. Let's discuss our journey of self-discovery, joy, presence, and living with authenticity. We can create positive change in the world, and it starts within each one of us. Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. Mondays at noon on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver. Hi, welcome to Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. I am your host, Marie Bernard. Thank you for being with me today. And this is CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, or you might be listening in Kamloops at CFBX or Axe Radio Canada in Nova Scotia, or you might be listening online at CITR.ca, CosmicDimensions.com, EmpowerRadio.com, or on the Co-Creator Network. And today we have a very special guest, Dr. Bernie Siegel. He's been on the show a couple of times, and he is one of my absolute favorite guests. And Dr. Bernie Siegel retired from general and pediatric surgical practice in 1989 and has since dedicated himself to humanizing the medical establishment's approach to patients and empowering patients to induce their own healing. And back in 1979, he took a class from Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross that focused on the use of crayon drawings as part of the healing process, especially for patients facing life-threatening diseases such as cancer. And he now has the book, The Art of Healing, Uncovering Your Inner Wisdom and Potential for Self-Healing. So welcome to the show, Dr. Bernie Siegel. Hi.
Well, thank you, and hi to you.
Thank you for being with me today. So you haven't been on the show for a couple of years. I guess you've been working on your book. What's new with you?
Well, I'd say I keep learning. You know, it's interesting because you mentioned books. I tell people now to read the same books every year or two. And if the book doesn't get better, they haven't changed. Because I noticed that accidentally with an audio lecture in the car, you know, that I was on a long drive and I put it in, even though I'd heard it many times before, and I thought, wow, this is better than I remembered it. But I realize it's because I've changed. So I was more, you might say, tuned in to things the person was saying, and now I do the same thing with books. I'll mark what I think is important in the book, it's a real lesson for me, and then read it again a year or two later and notice things are jumping off the page that I never noticed before. And that, to me, says, okay, you're learning and more aware, and it's a good sign. So I just recommend it to people as a natural way of seeing if they're evolving constantly and not limited and not, you know, with their mind not opening to new things.
Awesome. So would you recommend doing that with every book or just some of the books that you're
well,
are your
books
most favorite?
That mean something to you, you know,
yeah.
To begin with.
Because there's only so many hours in the day to
yeah,
reread
right.
books.
So you could have some around the house, and if a book, you know, really seemed full of wisdom to you, fine. Just put it aside or next to your bed, and a year or two later, you know, before you go to bed, read a few pages every night and see if new things are coming up for you.
Mm. So what do you mind sharing with us what some of the most important books are to you, other than your book, The Art of Healing?
It's interesting because I'm always recommending a novel by William Saroyan called The Human Comedy. That may sound crazy, you know, for a doctor, but and then I can get into other books. But it takes place during World War II and, you know, very similar to what's going on now with people, you know, their children dying in the war and all kinds of problems with veterans and others. And it faces life and death. A teacher talks to children about how to go out in the world. And so I just found it full of, as I say, wisdom about life, even though it's a novel. Let me quote one thing, because recently at a funeral of a relative of ours, I read it from it, because when the brother dies in the war, a gentleman says to his brother who's at home, "The best part of a good man stays forever, for love is immortal and makes all things immortal, while hate dies every minute." Mm. And that's a message you'll hear over and over again from many authors. But it's something I try to teach people, that you want to be immortal, love somebody. I mean, there was a nursing home where my some of my relatives were staying, and I used to go in there and work with the seniors who lived there and do some workshops and have them draw pictures and things. And one day I said to all of them, draw yourself today and 25 years ago. And everybody handed me the same picture except for one man. And the picture was, I used to be slim, I had hair, and I was smiling. Today, I'm fat, bald, and unhappy. And Bill handed me one picture, a big smiling face. I said, Bill, I asked for two pictures. He said, look at what it says. And in the margin, he had written, that's me then, that's me now. Now, this was a guy who walked around this nursing home helping other residents, spreading his love, you know? I mean, he was never there complaining or needing help, or ask. I mean, he was always out there giving. And then when my relatives weren't there any longer, I hadn't been there for like 10 years, went back one day for something and walked in. And in their library, there's one photograph on the wall, and it's Bill. So when I walked through, I said, oh, there's Bill. And the man who's in charge of the place now said, how do you know who that is? And I told him what a wonderful man he was and how I knew him. But what impressed me is the only photograph of any former resident on the wall in that nursing home is Bill. I mean, he's immortal now, if you know what I mean, because he walked around loving people, and they felt it, and there he is hanging on the wall and, you know, there forever. And I often show a slide of his drawing, you know, seniors and others, to get them to understand that connection is never ending. So keep loving, and you benefit from it too, as well as the people who receive it.
I love that story, and it is in your book, The Art of Healing, Dr. Burney. And
oh, it is? Good.
Yeah, it mentions Bill and because you have a whole section where with the drawings where they're analyzed and all of that. That actually brings me to something I wanted to bring up, because I feel like you really give a lot to the world. And, you know, doing this show for more than 5 years now, I meet so many people and I get to see what they're really like behind the scenes, not on stage. And I have to say that my every interaction with you has been completely authentic. There was a time quite a few months ago that I reached out to you on Facebook for some help, and you were willing to help me out. You didn't ask for anything in return. And I just wanted to share that with everyone, because it's really rare to find someone who really walks his talk.
Well, I try to, what I call, live the sermon. I work at it every day. I got plenty of troubles too, you know?
Yeah.
And a sentence I like from Joseph Campbell, he said, when you're walking through hell, say, what am I to learn from this? And that's what I've learn to do. But I can tell you how I knew I was genuine years ago. We have five children, and my wife and the kids would come with me. My wife ultimately became a part of the presentation, using humor and comedy, you know, like a Henny Youngman, but a female version, to show people what laughter did for them. So, but people would come up to me after the lecture and say, we know we can rely on you. We know you're genuine. And I said, what are you talking about? How do you know about me? Your wife and children are sitting in the front row in the audience.
Mm.
And I thought, wow. I mean, that's how I lived and grew up. You know what I mean? I'm not a different person at home than I am outside it. But I thought, yeah, there are a lot of celebrities who never have their family sitting in the front row because they're putting on a performance, if you know what I mean, and not being that person. So they don't want to get at home and then have their family say, oh, you said this, but you're not doing it. So our kids knew that they could, be my coach as well. I loved what they used to say to me. You're not in the operating room now. I mean, that was a wonderful sentence, because I'm a surgeon. You know, when you're in the operating room and you're the surgeon, you're in charge and telling everybody what you need and what to do. But at home, if I'd become, you know, that overpowering or bossy kind of guy, they'd say, Dad, you're not in the operating room now. And that used to get me to take a deep breath and, you know, settle down again.
Well, I guess family is a good way to keep you in check.
Absolutely, yeah. Mm-hmm. Because I think if they know you're genuine, then they also live the message and know it's real. I mean, mm-hmm. I used to bring all our kids into the operating room at night and on weekends because we were breaking the rules. But I wanted them to see what I was doing because they were mad at me for being a surgeon. You know, I mean, you got a crazy life, crazy schedule, running to the hospital, emergencies. They weren't happy that their father was a doctor. And I may add, none of them are a doctor today because they saw me struggling with the emotional aspects. I always say I became a doctor for healthy reasons, I mean, meaning I cared about people. And it's painful to be a doctor and care about people because you can't cure everything. Complications happen, deaths happen, and these are things you're not prepared for. But I have to say, what changed my life, to get back in a sense to the book, was at a workshop, which I thought was for doctors, run by Dr. Carl Simonton, to help cancer patients. I was the only doctor out of 125 people in the room. That blew my mind.
Wow.
Not one doctor from the whole state of Connecticut, except me, comes. Maybe I'm the only one in pain, if you know what I mean, caring about people. But sitting next to me, see, now there's no desk, if you know what I mean. We're in the audience together, so my patients all migrated over and circled around me. And this young woman with breast cancer said to me, "You're a nice guy. I feel better when I'm in the office with you, but I can't take you home with me, so I need to know how to live between office visits." And that redirected my life because I figured if I could help people live, I won't feel like a failure. Even if I can't cure their disease, I can help them live with it, you know, which, and then I learned, you see, to summarize, that if you help people live, they didn't die when they were supposed to. I know that sounds crazy to say, but, you know, if you really begin to enjoy life, knowing it's you're here for a limited time and that you then accept that, it was amazing, the benefits of it. You know, waking up every day joyful instead of complaining like Monday morning, more heart attacks, strokes, suicides, and illnesses. So when people changed their life, they began to teach me because I always said it's about stories. You know, I'd meet people I thought were dead, and I mean that literally when I was out lecturing, and they always had a story about why they didn't die. And so, you know, we started support groups, and I, that was another lesson. I was amazed at how few people showed up. When a doctor sends you a letter saying you want to live a longer, better life, come to a meeting, instead of a few hundred people, because we send 100 letters out, you get less than a dozen women showing up. And I thought, what is going on here? I'm trying to help them live, and they don't show up. But again, it had to do with how they were parented, the guilt, shame, and blame. You know, I'll do it wrong. If I don't get well, I'm a failure. Oh, it was unbelievable. You know, I'm not an artist. He asks you to draw pictures. You know, when somebody comes in who's trying to deal with cancer and says, I had my 10-year-old son draw this because I'm not good at drawing. Ma'am, yeah, how are you going to handle the cancer if you can't do a drawing, you know?
Wow.
But those are the kinds of things that woke them up. And one, which I hope it's in there, was the male engineer. When I said to him, please draw me a picture, he gave me a page, a full page of instructions, all written out, about how to draw the picture he was supposed to draw. And when I said to him, I asked you to draw a picture, those were the instructions. And that shook him up in a healthy way. I mean, he realized, wow, I'm living in my head, you know. I'm always the engineer, or a lawyer put it another way. While learning to think, I almost forgot how to feel. And so, you know, they both woke up when there was a disaster to paying attention to feelings. And I love saying it as, when you live in your heart, magic happens. Mm-hmm. And let your heart make up your mind. So when people shifted to letting their heart make up their mind, then their body got the message that they're enjoying life, and please keep them here as long as possible.
Beautiful. I believe the engineer's writing / drawing is in here. Yeah. I have difficulty drawing my visualizations. It goes on to talk about his kidneys and liver. Is that him?
Yeah. I'm not sure because I don't.
There's a whole page of just writing in the pictures.
But many years later, I may add, I was lecturing at Yale, and out of the audience came a young man who said, "That's my father's handwriting. Could you make a print of that so I can put it up on the wall at home because it had such a wonderful effect on him?"
Hmm.
So I got a photography shop to make a big picture of it that he could take home and hang on the wall. But part of the theme of the book is how to make the invisible visible. Things that doctors are not told, and I mean this literally, are that, oh God, maybe 90 or more years ago, Carl Jung interpreted a dream and diagnosed a brain tumor correctly. I drew the picture, as you mentioned, for Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, and she started asking me questions about my life. Now, this was a scene from my imagination, that I used for meditation, where I would walk and meet my guide and so forth and so on. And she was asking me questions that were like, wow, where's that coming from? And then she, like, what are you covering up? She said, Bernie, the page is white. You used a white crayon on top of that white page to make snow on a mountain. What are you covering up? And it was all my feelings. But, I mean, it made so much sense, all her questions, that I literally went back to the hospital with a box of crayons. And she hadn't taught me anything about it. But by working with my patients, what they drew, what happened to them, I thought I was discovering an incredible world, of information. Sent it to a medical journal. Came back saying, interesting, but not appropriate for our journal. I sent them to where it was appropriate, and they came back saying, it's appropriate, but it's not interesting. We know all this. That shook me up, because what they were saying, basically, was, this is nothing new. And these were psychology and psychiatry journals, Jungian journals, and that's when I began to explore and realize this is a whole world that you were never taught about, and began to use at the hospital. And the hospital and the people in the hospital, again, their first reaction is, you're nuts. What is that going to accomplish? But then when they began to see the value of the drawings, then they were all transformed. And actually, one of the operating rooms made a coloring book for kids. So the kids would fill in many pages, and then, the anesthesiologist realized they would know about the children and all kinds of things about family and the child and, how they're going to react to anesthesia and everything else. And it was all there symbolically. It can be related to colors that they used and things of that sort. But, and especially when physicians know anatomy, psychotherapists don't. When they would see anatomy in the drawing, then it really got them excited that the person, like with the dream, was revealing what was wrong in their body, even though they didn't know they were drawing anatomy. Well, one that was very simple, the sails on a boat, a woman drew with spots on it.
Oh, you can
hold
tell.
It up in front of an audience, everybody says, oh, it's her breasts.
Mm-hmm.
And so, there were different things that you could show, and people knew what part of the body it was. And as a doctor, I could tell even more, because I remember coming in, one man who was jaundiced in the hospital, I was asked to see him as a surgeon, that he might have a blockage in his bile ducts. And lying on his bedside stand, I didn't even ask him to draw a picture, was a picture. It happened to be a picture of a tree. All the branches on the tree were like one line, like if you drew them with a pencil, it was one line. The trunk was normal, and then it was into the ground, it opened into like a tube that ran across the page. Not normal roots. And when I looked at it, I realized this looks like the bile duct. Going into the intestine and so forth and so on. And what was unusual were the small branches. And I said to him, you don't need a surgeon. There's no blockage here. And I put it in his chart so other people could see it. And indeed, the disease he had was called sclerosing cholangitis. That's an inflammation in the bile ducts within the liver. See, they were blocked up with the inflammation. And that's just what he drew. And he wasn't thinking about anything when he drew a picture of a tree.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the kind of thing that converted people at the hospital. And it stopped being crazy and became very interesting and useful to everybody.
Thank you for that, Dr. Burney. Yeah, you do mention, you talk about dreams, interpreting dreams as well as interpreting drawings. And then there's a whole section of drawings in your book as well as descriptions. And you talk about, there's a little section to sort of train readers how they can start interpreting their dreams as well as their drawings.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, I mean, I had symptoms years ago, and my partners were very upset that I wasn't getting an exam right away. I could have cancer, blah, blah, blah. That night, I had a dream, because I promised them I'll go see a doctor. But that night, I had a dream, and I was running one of our cancer support groups in the dream. And I said to everybody, introduce yourselves, then we'll begin. And we went around the circle. When it came my turn, before I could open my mouth and say anything, everybody in the dream said to me, but you don't have cancer. And I woke up knowing, and indeed it was due to an infection. But, I mean, that dream told me. And then, it's not in this book, but in another book that called The Book of Miracles, that where we have incredible stories, not about health only, but just things that happen to people that there's really no explanation for. Well, I'd say the explanation is they chose life, chose to act in a life-enhancing way for themselves and everybody else. But this woman said in her dream, a dark-skinned woman with an accent comes in and says, you have a lump in your right breast. You need to have it looked into. She said, I woke up, felt my breast, and there was a lump. And I went to the hospital, and they diagnosed cancer. And they said to her, you'll have a doctor coming in who's going to be taking care of you in a few minutes. And she said, a few minutes later, the door opens, and into the room comes this doctor, a woman from India with an accent, who was in her dream. That was the person in her dream who told her. Now, you say, how does that happen? Well, it's, again, the universal consciousness. And that's why I like the term making the invisible visible, that if you never stop thinking, you know, your mind is in turbulence all the time, then these things are never going to happen to you. But when you can calm down, and that's why sleep, I always say sleep is vital for our survival. It's a dangerous thing to do if you look back before we had alarms and security and all kinds of things, because you could die sleeping in a cave if some tiger walked in. But I think we need to sleep to learn that inner wisdom. And again, go to sleep, your conscious mind quiets down, and then the unconscious can speak to you. And if you pay attention to it, a lot of nice things happen. I mean, there are dreams where a woman went to sleep, a cat named Miracle appeared, big white cat, and said, my name is Miracle, and here's the way to treat your cancer. Now, in a dream, she's told what chemotherapy to take. And she writes it down, tells her doctor who does it, and of course, years later, she's fine. And then there are other people, I may add, who when they draw their picture, draw the devil giving them poison as chemotherapy. And they wonder, why am I having a problem? Look at what your unconscious is saying to you, see? And they can convert that. Don't get me wrong. It doesn't mean to say, all right, stop, go home. But you can revisualize it. In other words, you can reprogram your body by picturing yourself having the treatment, doing beautifully, and going home feeling well, and you do that 4 or 5 times a day for a week. A week later, you have a totally different reaction because your body doesn't know you didn't have the treatment because you're picturing it. It thinks you're going through it. I mean that literally. So I know people who have no reaction to treatments, and I mean that, again, literally, I don't make up stories, but they'll say, I get out of the way, let it go to my tumor. That's a quote from a patient who confused the radiation therapist. He thought the machine was broken until she told him that. And then I know people, when the machine is broken, who act as if they're having all kinds of problems, you know, with inflammation, red skin, and shrinking tumors because they think they're getting treated, and they're not. So I am very impressed with the power of one's mind and how much of a physical effect it then has on the body, because our emotions, in a sense, become our inner chemistry. And I wish we would spend a hell of a lot more money, I always say, on inner space than outer space. I mean, our body is an incredible structure. I mean, Solzhenitsyn used the term self-induced healing in his book, Cancer Ward. That's not a word you ever hear from a doctor. See, doctors talk about spontaneous remissions and miracles. But you don't learn from those things. But if somebody said, yes, I've had a case of self-induced healing, you might say, well, how did you induce it? And his symbol of it was a rainbow-colored butterfly. So you get your life in order, the rainbow. And the transformation is the butterfly. So you transform your life, create that order, and look what happens to your body. And again, I'd say his using that symbol is purely intuitive. You know, that he's had cancer in his lifetime, and he had that inner wisdom and sense about it. And if everybody could do that in their life, then their body, again, gets that live message, and incredible things can happen. And you know, every time I say this, I worry about people feeling like I'm a failure, it didn't happen. We're all mortal. I mean, we're all going to die. What I'm talking about is enjoying living. As Mother Teresa said, I will not attend an anti-war rally, but if you ever have a peace rally, call me. So it's not about fighting a war against disease and empowering the enemy. It's how do I heal my life? How do I find peace? So if there are things in your life that are killing you, get the hell out of there or get them out of your life. And a way of knowing, think about this. Anybody listening to this who has an ache, pain, disease, anything, problem in your life, think about what words would you use to describe what you're going through. So you could say, I got a horrible marriage, I have cancer, I have a migraine headache. Okay, how do you describe the experience? Then when you come up with words, ask yourself, what else in my life fits the words that have a negative meaning? See, if you said, well, it's been a wake-up call, okay, I don't see that as something negative. But if you said failure, pressure, constriction, draining, roadblock, I'd say, all right, ask yourself what else fits your life, in your life, fits those words. What made you feel like a failure? See, don't tell me it's your body that failed you. I'm talking about your life. What's causing the pressure? What's draining you? And, you know, when people look at me, I mean, sometimes their eyes really pop because it's like, wow, I never thought of that. I mean, they know what's going on in their life, and then they go home and straighten it out, and then their body is benefited by it.
Well, thank you, Dr. Burney. It is time for a break, so we will be back with more synchronicity in just a moment. This is a fascinating discussion. I always love having you on the show, and so we'll be back in just a moment. We are talking right now with Dr. Burney Siegel. He is the author of many, many books, but today we are talking specifically about The Art of Healing, Uncovering Your Inner Wisdom and Potential for Self-Healing. And his website is BernieSiegelMD.com. And of course, you can always find me on my website, spiritualshow.com. And we will be back with more synchronicity momentarily.
Oh, I can't quit you, baby.
CITR is proud to sponsor the Vancouver International Film Festival showing of Bill Morrison's film, The Great Flood. Weaving together compelling archival footage of the Great Mississippi Flood of 1927, complemented by an original score by Bill Frisell. That flood led to an exodus of sharecroppers all heading north. The result? Chicago blues, rhythm and blues, and ultimately rock and roll. For showtimes and information, visit vif.org.
Media Democracy Days presents their fifth annual fundraising Concert Democracy Loud, taking place Thursday, October 17th in 2013 at the Railway Club, doors at 8 p.m. Funds raised go to support media reform and democratization in Canada. The event features three local bands and great prizes. Tickets are $10. For more information, visit therailwayclub.com and look under events.
Last year, over 650 BC teens aged out of foster care without a permanent family.
Adoption is not just for babies. Teens need families too. Only 24 teens in BC were adopted last year.
November is Adoption Awareness Month. To find out more about adopting a teen, contact the Adoptive Families Association of BC. Call 1-877-ADOPT-07 or visit us at bcadopt.com.
Tune in every Wednesday from 1 to 2 on The Shakespeare Show with your host Dan Shakespeare playing rare gems from the 20s to the 70s.
Welcome back to Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard, and right now we are speaking with Dr. Bernie Siegel. You can find him at BernieSiegelMD.com, and we're talking today about his book, The Art of Healing, Uncovering Your Inner Wisdom and Potential for Self-Healing. And Dr. Bernie, this book isn't just for sick people, right?
Right. I'd say it's for everybody, because if you get in touch with this inner wisdom, you know, your true self, let us say, then it'll help you in everything. Because, I mean, some of the examples, even related to drawings, if you said, I don't know what job to take, I don't know where to live, I wonder how my kids are doing, fine. Say, draw, you know, different jobs, different places you might want to live, what college to go to, ask your kids, because this I always recommend, ask your children, give them a full box of crayons so they have black, white, brown, and all the rainbow, and say, hey, draw a picture of our home and family. I want to put it on the refrigerator. Then take a look at it. And you'll know how your kids are feeling about the family. Because some of the pictures, again, in the book show the pain, you know. Numbers are a way we store memories, and I mean that literally. I mean, one in the book is a reporter who came to see me.
Oh, I love this one.
And she put a clock on the wall with one hand on it pointed at 12. And the reason I got her to draw a picture is because I knew she thought I was nuts and this was not going to be a fun interview. But when I saw it, to shake her up, see, rather than say, why is 12 important to you? And she could have denied or done anything. I just said, what happened when you were 12 years old? Well, I don't like deadlines. I said, look, there's one hand on the clock. What happened? And then came the tears in the story. Another woman drew a broken heart. She's having all kinds of pelvic problems. And a doctor friend said to me, you know, nothing we do is helping her. You got any ideas? I said, yeah, tell her to draw a picture and send it to me. She drew a picture of a broken heart, you know, like a Valentine heart, but cracked down the middle with 21 drops of blood. I said, ask her what happened when she was 21. And she'd been through a year of sexual abuse. And I'm sure that that brought forth, you see, the wounds and what she's been storing in her body. And now she can begin to heal by dealing with it. So it isn't, as I say, just for illness. It's for everybody and to help them. You know, when a child with cancer says, I don't get enough time for my family, and draws herself sitting on a chair all by herself and the family's on the sofa hugging each other with an empty seat, those parents cared and they changed. Or another child says, can you operate on me? They're teasing me in the locker room in the gym. Fix my body. I said, draw yourself in the operating room. The only crayon he used was a black crayon. He looks like an insect on the operating table. I said to his parents, he needs your love. I will operate. I'll fix his body so the kids don't tease him. But he needs your love, or he'll spend his life having plastic surgery, because every time he looks in the mirror, what is he seeing? Hey, and when you grow up with that guilt, shame, and blame, because of what parents say to you is hypnotic when you're a little kid up to the, you know, kindergarten age. It's really hypnotic. And, well, again, a quote from an adult. My mother's words were eating away at me and maybe gave me cancer. And, yeah, when she got cancer, she changed her life. You know, from wearing dark clothes, which her mother put her in so nobody would notice her, to feeling like a failure and embarrassing everybody. I mean, she started a new life, and it's such a pleasure to see all the things that she's doing now. And, you know, I've had other patients like that, too, who are claustrophobic, agoraphobic. I mean, they wouldn't even go out of the house. Her husband divorced her. She wouldn't write a check. She wouldn't do anything. Then she developed cancer, and I got to know her and, you know, helped her to get started living again. And I laughed because one day the phone rang, and it was her children. They said, "We're worried about my mother." I said, "What's wrong?" "She's out white water rafting and doing things and risking her life," you know. And I burst out laughing. But, you see, the curse became a blessing. I always say when you're hungry, you don't get upset. You get something to eat. She began to nourish herself and her life and wasn't afraid to go out there and do things, you know, that scared her kids. But she was now living. And what a difference that was.
Well, Dr. Burney, I thank you for that. And I wanted to talk about, it's so interesting to look at the art, and I haven't drawn a picture yet. I'm curious to see what that will look like. Because you really can, when you look at the examples in your book, a lot of them are very obvious. I mean, there was one where a little boy was supposed to be circumcised, and he had given you the pictures of before and after, and it was a fighter jet.
Yeah,
but you could see very clearly that it was a phallic symbol.
Right. Yeah, I love showing that to doctors and nurses and others, saying, if you want continuing medical education credits, you have to diagnose this correctly. And I say, this is before, this is after. What operation did he have? You know, and, you know, but you see, those are the things that changed people, as I said, in the operating room in the hospital. Because they'd look at it and it was like, wow. Or the one where the child drew the operating room she'd never been in,
mm-hmm.
you know, symbolically. But the yellow lights, the black knobs, the color of the sheets, the number of people taking care of her, they're all there. And so the people in the operating room, when they saw it, they knew what she was portraying. And it impressed them that that's within us. Yeah, I even, as a matter of fact, did a mural because one of the reasons I became a surgeon was I was a painter as a child, an artist, and I wanted to use my hands, you know, to keep making good use of them. And I painted the wall in the recovery room with all kinds of creatures and, you know, from fish tanks to penguins to everything wandering around, you know, with stethoscopes and different things. So when the kids opened their eyes, they'd have something to smile about on the wall, you know, not a blank wall. And so what we see makes a difference, too. You know, if you put up an outdoor scene in a hospital room, patients do better than if you put up an abstract painting. And the same in the operating room. If you play music, it benefits the patients and the time of the surgery than if you're working in silence. Now, again, it took years. I used to play music 30 and more years ago and, you know, brought in my own tape recorder and went ahead and did it. And today, we finally have studies verifying that, whereas I was called an explosion hazard back then because I brought an electric appliance in while you have all these, you know, explosive gases literally in the room. But everybody felt better. So after a few days, I got no complaints anymore, you know, about you're a hazard. Because if you feel good, you risk the hazard.
Well, thank you, Dr. Burney. And that actually brings me to when you talked about feeling good and seeing something that makes you smile. Mm. And there is a section about how pets help heal. And this is true for me. I've been a volunteer at a suicide prevention hotline. And one of the questions when people are suicidal we ask is, well, what's been keeping you going for this long? And so many times they'll say, well, I want to die, but I can't because my dog needs me.
Yeah.
So it gives them something to live for. Can you talk?
Yeah. I don't know which stories are in the book, but I had a woman with cancer who had 12 cats.
That one is in there.
Family said, you know, we don't even want to visit her anymore because the house smells. And now that she has cancer, we've got to get rid of them. I said, no. I said, you go in and clean the house and tell your mother nobody wants the cats. Then she can't die. You see, and I mean, almost like pets, I've had a mother say, I have 9 kids, I can't die till they're all married and out of the house. But you see, the sad part is she died when the 9th kid left home. Now, how she kept the cancer under control for 20 years, that's the part that blows my mind about the human body. I mean, her cancer came back 20 years later when the kid left home, because then she stopped being mama. And she should, I always say, have been her own child, see? So she would have then said, good, now I can take care of myself and enjoy myself. You know, I would use these techniques with people all the time, and more so with the women. See, the men say, I can't work, what's the point of living when the family's in the room? But again, studies show, more of these were done with heart attacks, where if you go home to a house with a dog, a year later, 5% of the people died a year after a heart attack. No dog, 26%. Another study I just read about was if you have cats at home, you have a 25% less chance of having a heart attack. And one done many years ago, stockbrokers with hypertension were given medication to treat the high blood pressure. Half of them were also sent home with a dog. And, of course, those who had the dog, their pressure went down much more than those who just took the medication. So, you know, all those things affect us. I mean, and again, it's our chemistry. If you pet a dog, your bonding hormones go up. Oxytocin, serotonin, that the same that happens after a woman gives birth. And I always get a kick. You know, when I walk, we have two dogs and a bunch of cats, too. But when I walk the dogs, people talk to the dogs, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
They come by and they say, oh, hello, look at the cute kids, you know. I mean, I get into the action, too. But it's so interesting how there is more bonding when you're walking the dogs than if you're walking alone and people just go by, you know, and don't look you in the eye or say anything.
Oh, that is so true. And it's interesting how, yeah, you want to get involved and interact. And there's also something that you were talking about on, I believe it's on page 61. I just wrote here that one study showed a correlation between cancer and a lack of a close parental bond as child. So I'm wondering, would having pets later in life maybe counteract some of that? Because I think a lot of people have that problem.
I think they take their place. In other words, there have even been studies done with seniors with plants in a nursing home. It's like on the right side of the hall, a plant was put in, and they were told, you are responsible, take care of it, water it, sunshine, etc. On the other side, the left side, they said, we're decorating your room. The people who were given responsibility for the plant lived several years longer than the people across the hall, you see, who were told, we're decorating your room. So any relationship with a living thing prolongs your life, makes your life more meaningful, and has benefits to you, absolutely.
Well,
and that's why, you know, people don't like people, you know, and relationships. I mean, in other words, whatever business you're in, whatever your life is about, you need to incorporate the people into it. Again, the tragic part is, and I show a couple of pictures, when you say to medical students or doctors, draw yourself working as a doctor, I mean, there are some pictures where no person is in it, just instruments and things. Most of the pictures, you know, you're sitting behind a desk with a diploma on the wall, or you're touching somebody with a stethoscope. I mean, that's not caring for people. You know, to me, that's not being a doctor. That's treating a disease. And that one young man, who, as a medical student, who drew himself kneeling in front of a woman, giving her a tissue. And he's got a stethoscope, but he's not touching her with that. He's handing her a tissue. I always say that's what being a doctor is about. You're helping the patient to be comfortable. There was an ad in a medical journal that said, I was depressed, unable to cope. I went to see my physician. He prescribed an antidepressant. I feel better now. I wrote to the company making the drug and to New England Journal of Medicine, and I said, would you put another line in that says, sit down, tell me what's troubling you, what's, you know, what's going on in your family that may make you depressed? I said, I mean, how can you have somebody come in and say, I'm depressed, and say, here's a pill, and they cancel the ad? But that, to me, is the part that drives me nuts. You see, I have a problem, take this, do this, have an operation. You have to treat the experience of the person. Then they do far better. See, when patients said to me, you know, that they drew themselves, and you'll see pictures in the operating room where love and God and the surgeon isn't covered with a, you know, cap mask and gown and hugging them. Yeah, they wake up from surgery and don't have any pain at all, and major surgery. And the nurses used to say to me, your patients are a problem. I say, what's the matter? They're refusing pain medication. I said, did it ever occur to you they're not hurting? And it didn't occur to them, because how can you not hurt after an operation? But after a while, they realized these people, you know, are not normal patients. And I mean that in a complimentary way, because they used to be called Siegel's crazy patients. But it became a compliment, not a negative statement. And they realized these people were not hurting. So they changed what they wrote in the chart, you know, and understood that it made an enormous difference, their attitude towards the surgery and towards the doctor and everything else played a big role in it.
Well, Dr. Burney, there's a few things that I wanted to touch on that kind of came up in that little discussion there. And I'm not sure where you'd like to go. There is mention of performing a surgery without anesthetic in the book.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And I also wanted to ask you, sorry, because we touched on a few things. We were talking earlier about plants and being responsible for them. And there is, you do talk about plants and how they face adversity. We only have about 12 minutes left in the show, so I'm wondering, where would you like to take this conversation next?
Well, I can do it quickly, both things.
Okay.
The gentleman had come into my office, and he and I got in such an intense discussion that, you know, he lay down on a little operating table. I prepared everything, picked up the knife, and made an incision. And the nurse was waving her arms frantically in the room. And, I'm not looking at her like, what's wrong? And she finally pointed that I hadn't used any of the anesthetic, local anesthetic agent. And I said to the patient, are you having any pain? He said, no. And so I finished, and then I told him I never anesthetized him. And both of us were in a trance, but it impressed the hell out of me how, you know, again, our mind can take care of all these things for us and how much hypnosis can do. The other was what I call, you know, that creation is intelligent, you know, that God loves all of us. So bacteria are able to alter their genes and resist antibiotics. I was just reading that trees, when they're covered with insects, create an aroma, and then the birds come and eat the insects. And it saves the plant. You know, viruses resist the vaccines, and you change it every year. And so it's built into us. You know, again, I always say a Band-Aid is a sign God loves us. You cut your finger, you cover it with a Band-Aid, take the Band-Aid off a week later, oh, look, I'm all better. Well, who figured that out? How does your body know how to do this? But there's an intelligence within it. Even a seed, this impressed me years ago, a road was paved over. I watched the pavement crack. I thought, oh, something's wrong with it. They didn't do it. But no, what came through the pavement was a skunk cabbage. So I brought the whole family down there. I said, I want this to be a therapist for you. You're paved over. You've run into a, you know, a wall in your life. But look what happens if you keep up the pressure. You burst through out into the light again. And the other thing I remember from reading, I thought, how does a seed know which way to go? How does it know what's up? You know, it's covered over, it's in the dark, but it said that seeds can sense gravity. So again, think of the intelligence that's in a seed. It knows this way up. And then it's beyond my belief how a seed can keep pushing and, you know, and create a plant that bursts through several inches of asphalt and appears out in the sunlight. But I have a photograph of that, and I show that slide when I'm lecturing, too, a lot of times. That, and I may add, my closing slide is of the four leaves, because we're all green leaves on the family tree. You know, hey, don't upset the family, fit in, look nice. Then the fall of your life comes. What do? Hey, get rid of the green. Let everybody know who I am. So I have a drawing, will the real me please stand up? It's the mommy me and the professional me. And you don't need to be a therapist to know what she enjoys is being a mommy, not being a professional, in terms of the colors and the expression on her face and so forth. And I would say to her, don't wait for a disaster. Listen to your heart. Go home and be with your kid. Mm-hmm. You know, just like you're saying that we run out of time, you know, especially when you're being interviewed, you run out of time. We're all going to run out of lifetime, so enjoy your time.
Oh, I love that, Dr. Burney. And we do have still a few minutes left, and I want to mention the name of your book again is The Art of Healing, Uncovering Your Inner Wisdom and Potential for Self-Healing. You can find Dr. Burney at BernieSiegelMD.com. And right in the beginning of the book, you talk about synchronicities and looking for signs and how you tune into the universe. And there's a story about finding a teddy bear.
Oh, yeah.
Can you share that with us?
Walking our dogs in the local town cemetery. I mean, because I love looking at the old stones from way back in the 1800s and everything else. And we were walking along, and it was just, I don't know what was going on in my life, but, you know, a day where I was feeling kind of drained and really needing something. And there in the road, because it wasn't on somebody's headstone, you know what I mean? It wasn't related to anybody who was buried, because I would never steal anything. But it was lying in the road, something white. So as I'm walking with the dogs, I walked up to it and picked it up. And it was this little white teddy bear. And on its chest was a big heart, and on it said, "Love me." I have it in our kitchen now, because when I walk past it, I think, "Be good to yourself, Koo." But it just said, "Love me." And it was, "Oh, thank you, thank you. I'll be good to me, too." And I don't mean being selfish, but about being good for myself and the world. See, you use the word synchronicity. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross used to say there are no coincidences. And that's why I said, when I looked at all those stories in A Book of Miracles, I realized it's when these people chose what was good for them, see, but in a life-enhancing way, they had those coincidences and synchronistic events happen. Who you meet, what happens, who shows up, who does something, and that it's not a coincidence that you have created that future. Well, Jung stated it this way: the future is unconsciously prepared long in advance and therefore can be guessed by clairvoyance. So when you're choosing, even unconsciously, in that life-enhancing way, yeah, the right things happen. And I've had patients of mine who are mystics, and healers, who, when I began to show who I was as a doctor, began to bring me messages from the dead, or even one who said to me, "You're going to write books?" I said, "No, I'm an artist. I'll never write a book. It's not the only C I got in college was creative writing." And here I am with 13 books. And she's become a real asset in my life, because she'll bring me messages, help me, tell me, and I can't deny the truth of her statements anymore, especially when she would come in and say, "I have a message from, you know," and say the patient's name, and I knew that person died, and then bring them a message that was spoken the way they spoke, you know, certain expressions and things, and when I'd call their family, they'd always say, "Oh, my God, that's what he said, you know, when he left the meeting." And so, again, I know that there's truth in this. And another that I think I mentioned in the book, that when a friend of mine, she's now done it twice, in California, Amelia Kincaid, animal intuitive, and I didn't believe, I thought, this is nuts that you talk to animals. You see, that's the why I live by my experience. I didn't let my belief stop me. So when a cat disappeared twice now, I have emailed her in California, and she has emailed me back and described exactly everything about the house and where the cat was. And it's just unbelievable what she's able to do. And she taught me, and excuse me, something in my throat, but what she taught me was, "Bernie, you need to quiet your mind. Then you get into the animal's mind, and it works." And I think that theme, the still pond, the quiet mind, is when you see the true reflection and really know yourself as well as what's right for you and begin to communicate on another level, let us say.
Well, thank you so much for being back on the show, Dr. Burney. It's just always such a pleasure. You're such a happy, bright, authentic man. Well, and I just always feel great anytime we have an interaction. So thank you. And again,
you're a good listener.
Thank you.
And it's easy for me to tell stories then.
Well, stories, I mean, I could talk so much about the book. You even talk about how you've given all this evidence to doctors and they'd discount it until they hear the stories.
That's really why I wanted this book put together with the drawings, because they can't deny what they'll see.
Mm-hmm. Well, is there anything you'd like to say before we close the show and Parts Unknown comes up?
No, I think, as I said, to tell people to follow their hearts, because that's the most important thing. I always say that there are a lot of schools and churches named Sacred Heart, but you never find one named Sacred Mind or Brain. And so follow your sacred heart.
Mm, what a beautiful way to close the show. Thank you so much, Dr. Verney. Have a great week,
dear.
And good luck with your book.
Okay.
Thank you. Bye. So again, that was Dr. Bernie Siegel. You can find him at his website, BernieSiegelMD.com. His book is called The Art of Healing, Uncovering Your Inner Wisdom and Potential for Self-Healing. You can find that everywhere that books are sold. And I'm your host, Marie Bernard. Coming up in just a moment here on CITR is Parts Unknown with DJ Carissa Riffick. So stick around for that. And I hope that you have a wonderful week. I'm going to close the show with a little Ziggy Marley, Love is My Religion. I haven't played that in a long time, and Dr. Bernie really seems to live that as well, so I just thought it was very appropriate. So I want to send you so much love. Be well. I love you so much. Namaste.
To find out what this life is worth, through the books and Bibles of time, I've made up my mind. I don't condemn, I don't convert. This is a calling.
Love is my religion.
Love is my religion.
Love is my religion. nobody stop us. Free spirits have to soar. With you I share the gift, the gift that we now know.
Hey, Horace, give us three shots of your best bourbon. And have that Russian waiter I like bring it over.
Hello, hello, hello. My name is Russian Tim, and I'm the host of weekly punk rock radio show called Rocket from Russia. Tune into CITR 101.9 FM every Thursday from 10 to 11 a.m. And you can also find the podcast on CITR.ca, iTunes, and my blog, rocketfromrussia.tumblr.com.
Media Democracy Days presents their fifth annual fundraising concert Democracy Loud, taking place Thursday, October 17th in 2013 at the Railway Club, doors at 8 p.m. Funds raised go to support media reform and democratization in Canada. The event features three local bands and great prizes. Tickets are $10. For more information, visit therailwayclub.com and look under events.
Live at Rickshaw presents San Francisco Psychedelic Garage Rockers, the OOCs with Blind Chick and OBM Thirds at the Rickshaw Theater Wednesday, October 16th. Get your tickets at live@rickshaw.com. Follow at Rickshaw Theater on Twitter for more information.
$1 billion on the ground, all stretched out and uncurled, would extend about four times around the circumference of the world.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the Main Street area at
Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, RX Comics, Red Cat Records, the Regional Assembly of Text, Temple of the Modern Girl Boutique, the Wallflower Modern Diner, and Woo Vintage Clothing.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or online at citr.ca.
You are listening to 101.9 FM. It is the Parts Unknown Show. Brace yourselves! Brace yourselves.
Stay out!
Perhaps the greatest band, I would think, that I have not seen, but that would be an amazing show to happen to Vancouver if only, wait, this Wednesday, Guitar Wolf from Japan. Bass Wolf, Drum Wolf, Guitar Wolf, all here. There's a gentleman of Guitar Wolf that had passed on a few years ago, sad, but they have found another member of this leather-clad explosion, Amps to 11 rock and roll, that only Japan can... Well, I don't know if it has anything to do with Japan. Just this band is... The first time that I heard the song Fujiyama Attack, I couldn't believe it. There has not been a band since the Stooges to build such anger and fury into a CD like the band Guitar Wolf. And they are playing in Vancouver at the Rickshaw Theater. The whole bunch of fantastic bands that if I had it in front of me, I tell you, Guitar Wolf with the song Sky Star Jet. They had this video for this really good song that just came out last year, but like that song better. Speaking of rock and roll... Last week I wasn't here. That's not rock and roll. But this is. The Fall Down, Get Down is fast approaching. It's coming next month. And I just heard about it last week. So I couldn't tell you about it. And I'm sure you know now. But from November the 14th to November 17th, a whole bunch of venues in Vancouver are going to bring the finest rock bands in the world to Vancouver. It's not just the Astoria that's going to get it. It's not just the Rickshaw. It's not just the Biltmore. But those venues will host the Fall Down, Get Down. This band will be playing. They are from San Francisco, and they call themselves Cool Ghouls. Now, there's a whole bunch of great bands, included Rocky Erickson. Ah! 13 Floor Elevators himself. Little long in the tooth, but he can still rock. Just like I found out with R. Stevie Moore. The guy is aged, he's got a bum leg, but he can still put on an amazing show. Can Rocky Erickson? Gonna have to find out at the Fall Down, Get Down. Also playing there is Cool Ghouls on 101.9 CITR.